Welcome back to the Deep Dive. Today we are strapping in for, well, the ultimate engineering challenge. We're doing a deep dive into the latest on Starship P3 and the rapidly evolving roadmap for getting humans to Mars.
And that roadmap has become much, much clearer recently. We're really moving from, you know, aspirational goals to actual hard engineering dates and problems that need solving.
Right. And the mission for us today is clarity. We want to chart that path from theory to reality, looking at the hardware, the timelines, and the huge biological hurdles we have to get over.
And that whole path really began right here in Texas. Mm. You have to start with the foundational success that underpins everything else. Your sources are really clear on this. 2025 was the year.
The year the economics of spaceflight just fundamentally shifted.
Exactly.
And it all came down to the catch. We're talking about consistently catching that massive, super heavy booster with the Mechazilla Tower arms. For anyone new to this, it might not sound like a huge deal, but why was that the single most critical challenge of 2025?
Well, it was the ultimate test of control. I mean, think about it. You're trying to catch a falling skyscraper with what is essentially a giant pair of chopsticks.
Yeah.
The Super Heavy is the heaviest rocket ever built. It's coming down fast, and they have to use these tiny grid fins and the Raptor engines to stabilize it against winds, against atmospheric chaos. If you miss,
you lose a $200 million asset every single time.
Every time. Mastering that catch guarantees full rapid reusability, and that is the engine that drives the entire Mars plan.
It's the difference between buying a new airplane for every flight versus just, you know, refueling the one you have.
Precisely.
Yeah.
Without that, Starship is just a very, very expensive monument.
Okay, so with the booster now mastered, the focus for 2026 is all on the upper stage, Starship V3. This is the ship that actually makes the trip, and it's a big leap forward in design.
It's a lot taller, built to push that payload capacity way beyond 100 tons. You need that to carry the first habitats, the first real hardware.
And the refinements on V3 are what really signal the intent here. I think we should start with the skin of the ship, the thermal protection system, or TPS tiles.
Yes, the thermal tiles. They just look like these simple black hexagons, but they are absolutely mission critical for a Mars landing.
More so than for an Earth return.
Oh, absolutely. Re-entering Earth's atmosphere is tough, but Mars is a whole different kind of punishment. The atmosphere is incredibly thin, like 1% of ours.
You don't get as much air braking.
Exactly. You hit that thin atmosphere at interplanetary speeds, which means you rely almost purely on heat resistance. The tiles have to dissipate this incredible energy.
So a single cracked or missing tile
could be catastrophic. A total structural failure as you're slamming into the planet. The new V3 tiles are, from what we're seeing, more uniform, more resilient. They're engineering out every possible weak point.
And the power behind it all, the Raptor 3 engines. This is where the specs get really exciting. We know they're more powerful, but what's the key technical change that unlocked all that performance?
The big innovation is the integral cooling channels.
Okay, what does that mean?
So historically, rocket engines needed this heavy external heat shielding to stop them from, you know, melting themselves. With Raptor 3, they've basically built the cooling system into the walls of the engine itself.
So you get to strip away all that extra weight.
You get rid of all that heady, passive shielding. Lighter engines mean more payload, better performance. And that directly ties into why everyone's so excited about the specific impulse, the ISP.
Let's break that down for our learner audience. ISP is...
ISP is just the efficiency metric. It's the rocket engine's miles per gallon. How much thrust do you get for a certain amount of fuel?
And for Methalox methane and Oxygen Raptor 3 is pushing the limits.
It's pushing the theoretical limits of what is chemically possible. Mm. They're squeezing every last drop of energy out of the fuel. It's just a beautifully efficient machine.
So we have the ship, we have the engines, but all of that is totally useless without one absolute non-negotiable prerequisite.
Orbital refueling.
Orbital refueling. They have to nail it this year.
Correct. The whole point of V3's massive lift capacity is to get propellant, tanker loads of it, up to low Earth orbit. The Mars ship waits up there while multiple tankers come up and top it off.
And why is that so critical? Why can't it just launch with a full tank?
Because if it did, it wouldn't have nearly enough fuel to escape Earth gravity, fly 6 months to Mars, do a compulsive landing, and, this is the important part, have enough fuel to come back.
So without refueling, Starship arrives on Mars as an empty tin can.
Just a shelter. A full Starship is a return vehicle. It's a colony asset. It's survival.
Yeah.
And the complexity of that, transferring those cryogenic fuels in zero-G without them boiling off. It's a whole new field of space plumbing they have to perfect.
Really making it routine.
Exactly. And the success of that directly dictates the human timeline, because we're all at the mercy of celestial mechanics.
The Hohmann transfer window. The best, most energy-efficient shot we get at Mars only comes around every 26 months.
You miss that window, you're waiting 2 years. So the roadmap now is shifting from wishful thinking to what the engineers are calling probable dates.
And what I find fascinating is how they're layering the risk across these windows. They're not just sending people and hoping for the best.
No, absolutely not. They're not sending anyone until the infrastructure is already on the ground and working.
Which brings us to the first big one. Late 2027. This is the cargo window. The Pathfinder mission. What's on board?
A whole fleet of uncrewed starships. Their first job is just to prove they can land safely with a full payload. But the real mission is to drop off the core assets.
The first robots.
Autonomous mining rovers. Huge solar arrays for power. And most importantly, the precursors for the fuel plant. The start of the Sabades system. Success here is absolutely non-negotiable.
And if that goes perfectly, that feeds into the next window, 2029. The aggressive target for the first humans.
The sources are crystal clear on this.
Mm.
2029 only happens if the 2027 landings are a 100% success, and they can verify remotely that the return fuel synthesis is automated and running.
You don't send the crew if their lifeboat isn't already waiting for them, fully stocked.
You got it. And if those conditions aren't met, which, let's be honest, is very possible.
Then we get to what's becoming the realistic date, 2031, the golden window.
And that window just makes more sense. It allows time to figure out human life support for a six-month journey. It lets the infrastructure land, get set up by the rovers, and run for 2 solid years. It guarantees the crew arrives at a powered, pressurized, and safe base.
It's a construction project where you have to finish building before the architects even show up.
Right. And speaking of those architects, those first people, Elon Musk's quote on this is so stark, and it's in your materials.
The first journey is not a vacation. It is dangerous, cramped, and you might not come back, but it is glorious.
I mean, they are setting expectations. This is for engineers and builders, not tourists. Extreme risk, extreme sacrifice.
Okay, let's move from the journey to actually living there. And to do that, you need to be able to work outside. For decades, our image of an astronaut is that bulky Michelin Man suit.
And that gas pressurized suit is a complete nightmare for doing any kind of real labor. You're literally fighting a balloon every time you try to bend your fingers. It's exhausting.
It's a deal breaker if you need colonists building a city for 12 hours a day.
Total deal breaker.
Mm.
So the paradigm shift here is the mechanical counterpressure suit, the bio suit.
So how does that work? How do you get pressure without gas?
It replaces the gas with tension. It's a multi-layered, highly elastic suit that applies mechanical pressure directly to the skin. It basically shrink-wraps you. Think of it like a super-engineered, custom-fitted body stocking.
And the immediate advantage is mobility.
Mobility, number one. Mm-hmm. Without that balloon effect, you have almost natural dexterity. You can kneel, you can climb, you can use fine tools. You can actually work like a human being.
And then there's the safety factor. This is huge. What happens if you get a tear?
This is the genius of it. In a gas suit, a puncture is catastrophic. You have seconds. In an MCP suit, a tear just means a localized pressure failure. You might get a nasty bruise like a hickey where the rip is.
But the rest of the suit stays pressurized.
The rest of the suit is fine. You can literally patch it with a high-tech piece of tape and keep working. It turns a fatal event into a minor inconvenience.
That's incredible. And I imagine they're way lighter, too.
Oh, significantly. You remove all the ducts and pumps for the air. And your sources mention they're using materials like shape memory alloys. You put the suit on, and electrical current heats the alloy, causing it to contract and shrink perfectly onto your body. It's a perfect seal, every time.
But even with these amazing suits, Mars itself is trying to kill you. The biological challenges are just immense.
Yeah, we have to talk about the radiation. Earth has this powerful magnetic field that protects us. Mars doesn't.
No global magnetosphere.
Which means the surface is just constantly being bombarded by galactic cosmic rays and solar particle events from the sun. The GCRs are your long-term cancer risk. The SBEs can kill you in hours.
So the dream of living in those beautiful glass domes we see in sci-fi.
It's a complete fantasy. Pure fantasy.
So where do the first colonists actually live?
Underground. The first habitats will either be in natural lava tubes, or there'll be surface modules that are immediately buried under meters of Martian soil. The regolith, that's your radiation shield. A giant blanket of dirt.
And that dirt The regolith is also a problem. It's toxic.
It's a nightmare. It's full of perchlorates, which are toxic to the human thyroid. And the dust itself is as fine as talcum powder, and it's electrostatically charged. It sticks to everything.
So you absolutely cannot bring it inside the habitat.
Unacceptable risk. Right. Which is why they're designing these things called suit ports. The suit actually docks to the outside wall of the habitat. You crawl out of the back of it, and the contaminated suit never comes inside.
It's the ultimate mudroom.
The ultimate mudroom, yeah. But the biggest unknown, the one that threatens the whole idea of a self-sustaining colony, is the gravity trap.
Mars has about 38% of Earth's gravity, 0.38 g.
And we just don't know what that does to the human body long term. More importantly, we have no idea if humans can successfully conceive or gestate a fetus in that low gravity.
And if they can't?
Then the colony is a dead end. It's just a remote outpost that constantly needs new people from Earth. It never becomes self-sufficient.
So what's the potential engineering solution for that?
It's massive. You might need huge spinning centrifuges built into the habitats to create artificial 1G for sleeping or for gestation. Or, and this is much further out, you might need genetic engineering to adapt humans to a low-G environment. It's the ultimate hurdle.
All of which just underscores why you can't ship everything from Earth. Which brings us to the most critical acronym for survival, ISRU.
In-situ resource utilization. Making what you need from what's already there.
And the core of that is making fuel. It all comes down to a process called the Sabatier reaction. The inputs are two things they can get on Mars. Water, ice from underground, and carbon dioxide from the atmosphere.
It's an amazing bit of chemistry. Walk us through it.
Okay, so first, you use electrolysis to split that water, H2O, into hydrogen and oxygen. The oxygen is a bonus. You can breathe it. Then the Sabatier reactor takes the hydrogen and combines it with CO2 from the Martian air.
And the output is the miracle.
The outputs are methane CH4, which is your rocket fuel, and more water, which you can just loop right back into the system.
And that methane is the ticket home. If that automated Sabatier plant that lands in 2027 fails to work, the crew is stranded forever. It is the single most critical piece of hardware in the entire plan.
Which is why the robots have to build the city before the citizens arrive.
Right. And the workhorses for that will be automated 3D printers. They'll use the Martian regolith mixed with some kind of binding agent to print landing pads, radiation shields, warehouses, all before the first humans even leave Earth.
So we've covered the whole journey. From the Raptor 3 engines, the insane risk of orbital refueling, to the flexibility of the MCP suits, and the absolute necessity of the Sabatier reactor.
And when you step back and look at all of it, this project, it really puts humanity at the precipice of what's called the Great Filter.
That idea that there's some hurdle that stops civilizations from becoming interplanetary.
Exactly. And if we can pull this off, if we can establish a truly self-sustaining colony on Mars, a backup for our species, then the long-term survival of human consciousness is, well, it's pretty much guaranteed, no matter what happens back here on Earth.
The first Martians will trade the blue skies we take for granted for the dusty, salmon-colored twilight of a whole new world.
So we'll leave you with this to think about. Reflect on the sheer risk and the incredible necessity baked into this timeline. The question really isn't if these engineering problems can be solved, it's when. So, are you ready for the launch?